podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hi, everyone. And now to an interview I am particularly proud of because I was the recipient of a Cricket New South Wales Media Award for this interview with former Australian captain Alex Blackwell. Enjoy. Happy New Year, listeners, and welcome to the first Manners Masterclass of 2022. In this episode, I'm joined by former Australian captain Alex Blackwell. Until recently, Alex Blackwell held the record for representing Australia the most times in women's cricket, having done so 251 occasions across Tests, One Day Internationals and T20 matches. She won multiple World Cups and Ashes series with the team and is now a respected voice in the game. Enjoy this interview with Alex Blackwell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered. It's the Manners Masterclass series, and I'm joined by one of the greats of Australian cricket, Alex Blackwell. Alex, welcome back to the podcast. You've just released a new book, Fair Game. You must be pretty excited.
Yeah, a lot happening at the moment, Andrew. Book coming out tomorrow, and I'm 36 weeks pregnant as well, so I've got a baby about to arrive as well. So a lot happening, some life-changing things. And look, this book has been a really amazing process over the last couple of years, working with Megan Maurice, a very talented sports journalist, and I'm very proud of what we've been able to put together and documenting a significant moment or chunk of time in women's cricket, the time that I was a part of the national team and, yeah, I guess sharing my perspectives and observations.
It's a fantastic book. I've read most of it. And, you know, what I really like about it is you don't shy away, and it's no surprise, but you don't shy away from really digging into some, you know, really important social issues and issues that intersect with cricket. And, you know, they're almost the focal point of this book, or, you know, how important these issues are for you. So I think it's obviously a great service to female sport for you to write this book.
Yeah, look, I think I feel proud that I've found my voice throughout my career, sharing my perspectives and really thinking about the game and feeling like I belonged enough to contribute to its direction and speak up when I felt that maybe we could do things differently and a little bit more inclusively. And I think my story will resonate with many female athletes. And the way that we enjoy sport and the influence, I guess, of growing up, basically, like I spent my childhood and my young adulthood in sport, which in a male-dominated sport like cricket, there is sexism, there is homophobia, and that has its impact on you as a person growing up. And I guess in particular, if you happen to also be gay. So, you know, that's been my experience. And, yeah, I feel like I've agitated along the way to help people think about, all right, how do we welcome people who don't fit the norm, who, you know, don't live this sort of heteronormative life that once was common for everybody? You know, there's so many different types of people who enjoy sport, and we need to keep ensuring sport adapts to that.
Yeah, and I mean, you document some of the challenges, but I've just noticed, I mean, for context, my first published cricket article was in 2017 when Elise Villani came out. She changed her Twitter bio to an openly proud gay athlete. And I was researching at the time, and, you know, when she did that, you'd sort of been the only other female cricketer to take that step. So, you know, you were a trailblazer. You led the way for other female cricketers. I mean, what have some of your teammates and others said to you about that?
Mm. Yeah, it wasn't my intention to sort of be the first publicly out cricketer in Australia, first female in the world to talk openly about being gay in cricket. It was actually a male, Steve Davies, in England. He played a few test matches, I believe, a wicketkeeper batter, who was the first cricketer to come out as gay publicly. But look, I think I didn't sort of necessarily anticipate a lot of discussion from my teammates when I decided to do that. But I have had really wonderful responses from past players who just weren't in a position to be able to speak freely, and it's been amazing to hear the stories, or you know, some really lovely stories, but some very difficult stories from past players who have said to me, you know, thank you for saying what we couldn't. And I just feel really privileged that I'm in a country, an era, in a supportive family whereby I can enjoy these freedoms and be my true self. And I love my life, you know, wonderful relationship with my wife Lindsay, and we're soon to welcome our first child into the world, and I see that as an amazing privilege that others may not have been able to freely enjoy, and I feel sad about that, that it's been so recent that our female players, even where are our male players, you know, that our gay athletes can be truly themselves, and I think that's really only a very recent thing. Mm-hmm. And wonderful to have Elise Villani out and proud and doing great things as well.
You talk about male athletes. I think it was the first openly gay male athlete of one of the four football codes came out recently, A-League player. So, I mean, it's small steps. One thing you said about finding your true self, I sort of reading the book, part of your character, and not in all things, seems to be that you don't mind having tough conversations. It's almost like, you know, some people, they just want calm waters around them. But it sounds like to me, you'd be probably like everyone would like calm waters, but if you see something that needs to be dealt with, you don't mind rocking the boat. You know, where do you think that character, that quality came from?
Well, I think it comes from my upbringing, that my parents sort of instilled in me that I'm no different to anyone else. I'm no better and no worse than anyone else. And they encouraged me to pursue things that I was interested in, and provided many different opportunities to find out what I was interested in. So I did ballet, and then I rushed from ballet to soccer. You know, we were provided as kids with so many different experiences and opportunities. So I think just that notion that I'm worthy just as I am, and no better or worse than anyone else. And if I feel that my opportunities are limited because of an attribute of mine, then I'll speak up. I'm not sure that, Andrew, that I know any other way. I don't mean to make things difficult, but yes, I have had difficult conversations with, you know, some of the most powerful people in our sport over the years. And look, I think that's such an important thing for our women to do more and more of, because cricket is traditionally male dominated and it's still mostly run by men. And I think that we need our women, our young women, sharing their views and finding their voices. And I hope my story inspires others to also think about the game and speak up.
I think there is some resistance, or people get uncomfortable talking about, you know, sexuality and cricket and those issues that, you know, merge with social issues. I've noticed that, you know, people don't really want to talk about them. And so it's refreshing and important for cricketers and former cricketers like you to actually drive the agenda. And, you know, throughout the book, is littered with examples of you driving the agenda, you know, writing to James Sutherland after the Alan Border Medal in 2006, you know, taking your partner to the Alan Border Medal 4 or 5 years later. I mean, these are things that if you don't take that first step, then they just don't happen.
Yeah. And look, my approach has been that if I'm awkward about having these conversations, I can't expect other people to have these conversations freely. And look, you know, being gay is nothing to be ashamed of. And I think what has been difficult for, you know, my generation perhaps, or generations gone by, is that within society there's this expectation that that you live a very sort of, as I said before, heteronormative life, that anything deviating from that is abnormal. But we know that that's not the case. I mean, the LGBTQI population is significant. At a minimum, it's 11%. But as I've learned through, as you can imagine, I've been interested in the topic of inclusion, and I've seen research that tells us that actually our young people more strongly identify under that sort of rainbow umbrella. We've got perhaps more like a quarter that don't strictly identify as heterosexual, you know, and so a quarter of our young people coming through and choosing sports, I think cricket could be a really attractive option for both men and women, boys and girls, that we show we're not afraid to welcome everybody and we accept differences in sexuality and gender. And how great is it that cricket led the way with a trans and gender diverse inclusion policy, which you'll read about in the book as well. It was wonderful to participate in that policy development. Something that's not easy to get right. And, you know, we took 8 months to create those policies. And one of the things I'm most proud of was making sure we had trans and gender diverse voices in the room when we were thinking about, right, how do we include this pocket of our society into our wonderful game?
Yeah, that's such a complex issue. With, like, you speak about sort of rainbow culture, the rainbow, you know, kids being attracted to that. You know, I've got two kids and it's not even about sexuality. They just like the inclusive feeling that goes along with, you know, LGBTQI activities, that everyone's welcome and it's not trying to put people in boxes. So hopefully, you know, cricket can keep moving in that direction. You write that those off-field challenges have sort of made you the person you are. Do you think, why is that?
Well, it's taught me a lot about how to work with people who think differently and how crucial that is to be able to be at the same table with people who have very different views and to participate and to calmly and respectfully share my views so that as a group of people we can come up with the best solutions. You know, I guess it's been really something that I treasure, that I've had those experiences of challenging or necessary conversations that have taught me how to communicate better when I'm with people who don't share my view. Because it would be a shame if I didn't have those skills and so then I just stepped back and remained silent, because my unique perspectives, I wouldn't be able to, you know, share those and enable them to have an influence on the direction. So, it's taught me some leadership skills and some life skills which are helpful. In lots of different settings in life. But I think ultimately when you're subjected to subtle messages over a very long period of time, growing up in Australia, growing up in Australian sport, where we know there's work to be done around homophobia. When you grow up and you're exposed to that, and then you get to a point when you reject those notions, it's wonderful, because it means that within my own self I feel worthy and I feel good about who I am. So yeah, I guess I describe that as the making of me, that, you know, coming up against those challenges and things that aren't wonderful experiences, but to then the end result be that I don't believe there's anything wrong with me and I quite like the person I am. That's a pretty nice gift.
It's hard for everybody to find that sometimes, Alex. you talk about the sort of implicit and explicit kind of homophobia you encountered. Even you talk about playing in cricket teams where, you know, other male administrators would ask you, you know, how many gay players were there. And, you know, those things must have been quite distressing for you as a lesbian who just was grappling with your own sexuality. You're having this kind of negative messaging, and, you know, that must have been really difficult.
Yeah, because it's an irrelevant question. I mean, it's hard to sort of understand what is the purpose of that question, you know, and what's the right answer? What would be acceptable to the people asking the question? You know, why does it matter? And, you know, sexuality doesn't determine how good you're going to be on the field, but it does have an impact on, as I've observed, how you'll be celebrated, especially during years gone by. And they're the stories that I have documented, which I think is worthwhile for administrators to have a think about. You know, the practices of the past, which were within, you know, all good intentions to try and promote our sport, was trying to promote a certain image and discourage a certain image and move away from really celebrating the fact that there's out athletes in our team. And that's really challenged me over the years, and it's been something that I've spoken out about. And I'm pleased to say now, when I watch the AFLW and I watch the WBBL, and there's just really authentic stories about the athletes playing, and they're very generous with sharing their stories. And, you know, we're hearing all sorts of lovely, you know, moments where, you know, women are marrying their female partners or welcoming children into the world in a same-sex relationship, and it's just normal now, and it's wonderful to see.
Yeah, that attitude you speak of about sort of administrators asking those kind of questions, you know, I've been bouncing around in cricket for a while, and, you know, maybe 15 years ago you would hear that sort of talk, but I have to say I've only heard one comment that like that in the last 5 years, which for me is refreshing that it should be none, but at least it's moving in the right direction. I find it interesting, you know, you sort of talk about Cricket Australia, sort of the way they've promoted the women's game. You know, they have done wonderful things, and the WBBL is a testament to that. But it's interesting, that kind of subtle messaging where the athletes and the players, they're pushing forward and the other ones, they're holding back. It's probably something that they could have done better.
Yeah, look, I think, to me, there seemed to be deliberate sort of approaches to push forward particular types of players that would appear to the people in charge at the time be the recipe to success, to sort of attract mothers to bring their daughters to play. I mean, you know, this comment was not something I heard just once, and it was very distressing for me to hear that maybe I was viewed as someone that they didn't believe mothers would want their daughters to emulate. So, yeah, look, I think it's certainly changed. You know, I used to have to get dressed up in ball gowns for photo shoots and have a cricket bat over my shoulder and, you know, pretend to play a shot wearing heels in promotional material. And I think that sort of stuff's dated now. I feel like there's much more authentic ways that players are profiled. And, you know, to hear the backstories of people like, you know, Jess Cameron, who, you know, has a husband and a beautiful daughter, and to hear her backstory that she's a spare parts mechanic and, you know, she on tour, she would always get around in tracksuit pants and a cap. And, you know, just why do we need to change that image to present to the world? I mean, I think she's been such a remarkable player and a great friend of mine who I've always respected for just being her true self. And I think, you know, someone like her, as I describe in the book, could have been pushed forward because she was winning us World Cup finals off her own bat. And I felt like, you know, her image was hidden in a way. You know, and I guess I must also admit that not everyone enjoys being in the limelight. So, you know, some people do suit it more than others, but I think we should all have an equal opportunity to promote our game. And that's what we've got happening now.
Yeah, it's certainly moved on from just articles about Elise Perry to, you know, in-depth coverage of women's cricket and form issues. So, I think we're slowly getting there. We're going to take a quick break and then back with more in a moment. You're listening to Mena's Masterclass. I'm Mena's and I'm here with Alex Blackwell. You know, mental health is such an important issue in sport. And, you know, what you really outline is how what you came across in cricket affected your mental health and coming to terms with your sexuality, stopped you coming out and stopped you dating. And, you know, I think if cricket is serious about mental health in young people, then they have to get this right, making everyone feel comfortable so that when they go back home from their cricket club, they're not taking away that negative energy that it seems like you took with you.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that just makes me think that the problem isn't the gayness. The problem is that young people who feel they might be gay are not in an environment which is telling them that that's totally okay. So we can work on that environment, and we should not at all focus on having less gayness. You know, gayness is a natural thing. It's a part of human experience. And, you know, in some pursuits, there's more gay people than others, and that's okay. But, yeah, I think what we do need to do is support young people during that difficult period of their life where they're figuring out who they are, they're doing their HSC, they're trying to figure out their career path, they're under scrutiny, they're playing cricket on live TV. And those pressures are real. And if we can help remove some of the unnecessary pressures, then I think that would go a long way to support mental health. And I do... write in the book a little bit about the, as I mentioned before, the trans and gender diverse inclusion policy. We know that trans and gender diverse people have a much higher rate of mental ill health. And we know that sport and physical activity is such a good antidote to that. And so it's great that cricket's opened its doors to, you know, more and more trans and gender diverse people to come and try our sport and fully participate. I think that's something we can be very proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like in reading the book that the shift started in like to see real difference when the WBBL started and the BBL and, you know, clubs like the Sydney Sixers that are leaders have pride nights and stuff. Is that right that you think Cricket Australia, when the WBBL, all of a sudden they saw there was money involved in it, thought, well, we'd better run this properly?
Do you mean run the Pride events properly?
Oh, just the whole around inclusivity and promoting the women's game better. And as you say, promoting a range of female cricketers, not just the ones that fit their sort of ideal. It, you know, it was around that 2017, 2018 when it started to shift.
Yeah, it's hard to know, like, what the sort of real impetus for change is and was. But I feel like the players themselves being really generous with their own stories and speaking more freely these days has generated a sort of organic change, that inclusion and pride rounds, et cetera, are sort of necessary to sort of acknowledge what's going on in our sport. And I think that cricket, like many other sports, understand that it makes good business sense to include more people, and that it's about our longevity as a sport and our long-term prosperity, I guess, that our society changes and we need to move with the times and ensure that our doors are open to everyone. And that's not an easy thing to do. But I'm so pleased to see what the Sydney Sixers have achieved in engaging with an organisation called Rainbow Families. So seeing them doing sort of special days, engaging with families who may have two mums or two dads, or, you know, families, shapes and sizes. And they've also done a great job in creating a sort of rainbow fan club. And I think all of our BBL squads and teams could do that and really get a lot of fun happening around the grounds and in the stadiums.
Most certainly. I love the Pride Night at the Big Bash, the Sydney Sixers. Now, I enjoyed the bit about, you know, you wrote about your contributions to the marriage equality debate, and you spoke to Pete Lawler and you released a statement on your social media. But you drop in a little story about Stephen O'Keefe coming up to you in the gym and saying he was voting yes to marriage equality. I'm just wondering, was putting that story in by O'Keefe intentional? Because, you know, he received a lot of publicity for some, you know, vulgar and unsavoury remarks he made to a female cricketer at the Cricket New South Wales Awards dinner. I just wonder why you put Stephen O'Keefe's story in there.
You know, certainly not overthinking it as a story. It just sort of was a part of what was going on. I guess demonstrating that male and female cricketers do interact regularly. We train side by side, and, you know, people like Stephen and people of his era or even younger now understand that women are a serious part of our sport. And I guess, yeah, I wanted to demonstrate that. But, you know, what it does do, that story demonstrates that while the marriage equality debate was pretty horrific, actually, for gay people and really was very hurtful, there were some silver linings, and that was an example of one, you know, a conversation that wouldn't have happened otherwise, for he and I to, I guess, have a moment where we go, he's acknowledging that my rights are equal to his. And, you know, I've really respected that. And I do talk about some other conversations that were opened up sort of in my family circles around that time, and how important it was for people to be able to talk about the rights of gay people, whether that be their own children or themselves or people in their family, that it made us all stop and think, do these people deserve equal rights? And the answer was yes, which I'm so pleased that, you know, the number 62% or 63% of Australians said yes. And initially I felt like that wasn't a big enough number, but we got it done. And I was pleased to play a small part in being, I guess, a public voice at that time.
Yeah. Are there any sort of administrators or players or anyone that you've really sort of, gelled with and found like a real, momentum with to make change?
Yeah, look, I can't go past our current CEO of Nick Hockley at Cricket Australia. I have a lot of confidence with him in that he gets the inclusion and diversity issue, and he sees it as a priority. And I've seen him sort of genuinely participate in it, and just quietly participate in it, and that to me has given me great confidence. He's done that for many years prior to becoming our CEO, and I think he's someone who can really take this forward. Also, Mel Jones, director of Cricket Australia, she's someone who, she and I share in-depth conversations on this topic and can see that cricket could be a real leader in Australian sport. We already have been in many respects, but we can't sort of be complacent. I look at the way the AFLW have done their pride round and their rainbow jerseys, and I think they've done a great job, but sometimes I think the AFL, they're quite splashy and, things look good on the outside and I don't actually know what's going on the inside. And sometimes cricket appears to be slow and steady and trying to make meaningful change and not rush. And perhaps in the past I've been a bit tough on administrators because I'm in a bit more of a rush, I'm a bit impatient.
Revolutions are messy, Alex, that's for sure. What about some of the issues now then? So current issues, I've got a few. So I wonder how we should be treating same-sex couples within cricket teams, because I think this is an issue that's sort of there and it's only going to get more of it. How do we handle that?
I guess, I sort of throw it back to you a little bit and try and sort of understand what the potential problem of that would be. I think we have had same-sex relationships within teams, and, that occurs in many, we have relationships in many workplaces, and I think it just comes down to, as long as the behaviours that are demonstrated by those people involved meet the expectations of the team and the expectations of the organisation, then I don't see that there's any issue. I think it's more of a fear of potential issues than actually the reality. We just have to not focus on the person or the particular relationship. We need to focus on the behaviours and ensure that everyone is educated around what workplace behaviour is acceptable and what isn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm coming from. No, it's more from a workplace. How do they handle it? And therefore, say a captain, is dating someone who they have to drop, how do they handle that?
Yeah, and then that's a great example of, dealing with conflict of interest. And I learned how to do that as a board director on Cricket New South Wales, where I was the captain of the Sydney Thunder and sitting on the board. You have to sometimes excuse yourself in certain decisions. And I think that's, as a director, I went through that education of how to be a director, and dealing with conflict of interest is a big part of that. And so I think we can take some of those corporate skills and knowledge into our sporting teams and just deal with it professionally.
But what I'm saying, do you think it is being dealt with at the moment? Like, is it openly talked about?
I'm not sure that it's openly talked about, and maybe this is a really great opportunity for people to just be able to speak their mind. And I think, you know, one thing that is highlighted in the book is my openness to hear what Eddie Maguire was really trying to say about predatory behaviour in the AFL, AFLW. He felt that there was a connection with predatory behaviour and gay women. And in fact, there was some really important topics he was raising. And while I was offended with his profiling of lesbians as more likely to be predatory, there's something in what he's saying. He's talking about workplace behaviour. He's talking a bit about what you've raised, you know, relationships within teams. And I think people need to be able to speak freely, trying to use good language that's not discriminatory, but, you know, have robust conversation that goes back and forth. And, yeah, we need to be able to put it all out there on the table. And I think that's one thing I've tried to do is not be awkward in my conversations about LGBT inclusion. You know, I understand not everyone views the inclusion of gay people in sport at the same way. They see different issues or different benefits or drawbacks and to what I would. And we move forward by listening to each other. So I don't think that issue is right, like completely out on the table, but I also don't think it's a big deal. It's rare, and it's also mostly handled by our codes of conduct. But if those codes aren't appropriate or if they don't cover this particular issue, we just need to revisit that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the predatory behaviour stuff's silly because, I mean, that's wrong in any workplace, male, female. Whoever does that is wrong. So it doesn't matter whether they're lesbian, straight. You just, that's bad behaviour. And it comes from all types of people. And also, I think some men stupidly think that, you send a female into a dressing room, maybe they'll come out gay. Like all of a sudden they're all going to like change because they played a game of cricket with some people. So I think that's sort of outdated and sort of attitudes from dinosaurs. What about the most pressing issue? No free-to-air coverage of the 50-over Women's World Cup. I mean, that is disgraceful.
It just doesn't seem to make business sense because we've got the numbers. We've got the numbers of viewers who tune into women's cricket and top property at the moment. You know, this is the world champion T20 team taking on, trying to win that 50-over World Cup back from England, who are the second-best team in the world, in my opinion. If we're happy to broadcast the men's World Cups, I think we're really missing out, and Channel 9 are missing out, really, of putting on the women. It just does not make sense to me. Because it's a backwards step as well. It doesn't show that genuine vision of we're going to make women's sport equally as entertaining as men's sport, because it does come down to the production side of things as well. If you have few cameras, poor vision, and you've got, not great, but maybe you're commentating from studio all the time, which is unavoidable. We've done it a lot during COVID and done a pretty good job, but if you put the resources into it, I think you get a wonderful product back, because I mean, I love watching the WBBL. I find the BBL less entertaining at the moment. That's just how I'm sort of experiencing it. But once you put on the World Cup with equal production, sort of the bells and whistles, then the viewers will tune in.
Thankfully, your employers at Fox Cricket, Maddie Weiss, have decided to show the Women's World Cup on KO freebies. So you can watch me commentate on grey cricket for free, and you can watch the Women's World Cup. So you choose, listeners.
That's awesome. And I would say that it's wonderful to see Elisa Healy putting her weight behind that. She made a few comments on Twitter, which seem to have been heard. And it's, just great to see another female, finding their voice and just saying it how it is. And, good on Elisa for helping get that change across the line.
Absolutely. She's not shy in stepping forward. What about inclusive language? I find it really weird when people resist change, like from batsman to batter, or, third man to third. It just makes sense to me that you want language that you can use on all parts of the game.
I think it's an easy change to demonstrate that we're welcoming everybody, in particular female cricketers who have not enjoyed equal opportunity in our game since it began. And women have had such an influence on our game, in a positive way. We've created overarm bowling. We played the first World Cup. We've doubled the amount of cricket you get to watch. Isn't that wonderful? So, absolutely. I just think it's an easy shift. Who does it harm by changing, making these words shorter?
I don't
think it harms anyone. And it's a very clear demonstration of what we're trying to do. So I think it's a shame if people sort of push back on it.
Yeah, I am. I commentated on some New South Wales Women's Premier Cricket, and you see the atmosphere around the game there. It's so lovely. Everyone's enjoying the game, so it just makes sense that the language should reflect everyone participating. And I hope we're getting there. Like, I really get annoyed with myself when I make a mistake, because you just might say third man because you've said it for 30 years, but.
I do the same. I'll still slip up. We won't get it perfect all the time, but it's those who are really objectionable with it that I find interesting. I'm just thinking, who does it harm to sort of try and use more inclusive language?
Yeah, silly. Our last couple of questions, Alex, I know you've got a lot on, but so reading the book, it seems like the end of your Australian cricket career was, I would say, challenging. The changes within the team, you write about Matthew Mott's appointment as, taking a while for you to adjust to that. Meg Lanning's elevation to the skipper. It seems like it was a difficult sort of transition out of the team for you.
I guess that's highlighted by how I speak about the 2017 World Cup, one in which we were favourites and we went on to lose it. It was a tournament where I felt that I wasn't managed particularly well as a senior player and, an important member of the team. Some decisions around essentially non-captaincy as the vice-captain I found very difficult to understand, and I felt the communication was a little flimsy. But, you've got to move on. You've got to continue to try and perform on the field in my role as a batter, even though I felt a bit sort of put aside in terms of my abilities to contribute to the tactics and the leadership of our campaign. So it's a bit sort of confronting, that tournament. It was the hardest tour by far from a you know, how I felt managed as a player. You know, in my 15 years, that was the toughest tour. Because of those challenges. But I think what I'm trying to do there is have a critique of our performance, and the women's team should be analysed and critiqued for performance. And, you know, I've heard Elise Perry call for this, that it shouldn't all be glossy in the papers. We should be actually caring about what's happening within the team, the selections. We should be debating it. And I guess I do sort of shine a bit of a light on what occurred during that tournament. And, you know, some people might find that, yeah, their questions are sort of answered, because it was a bit baffling, some of the decisions that were made at that time.
Yeah, sounds like things have, I think they've developed, hopefully, with the way the team's going. But it sounds like there was issues there that did spur the team on to do really well after that. They decided to play fearless cricket from then on. But, you know, you in that semi-final made 90, was it, or close to 90?
Yeah, I was the last wicket to fall. My number 11 batted down.
Yeah, you almost got Australia over the line there in a desperate situation.
It was my best ever personal performance, but, yeah, absolutely gutted that India were too good for us on that day. Maybe it's good timing, because the Aussie women have a World Cup to win to sort of avenge what happened in 2017 when we were not at Lord's at a sellout playing against England in a match, you know, I'd back us to win. I just feel so devastated that we didn't. I know we've got a lot of World Cups for Australia, but I felt we could have had another one. And yeah, Australia are favourites again going into the World Cup in New Zealand in a few months, and I think they're going to do really well.
Yeah, I love those insights into the team, and I hope the listeners go and read them, because it does give you a great look into, you know, how the Australian women's cricket team functions. Last time I had you on this podcast, Alex, you were the most capped Australian female player, 251 times. Unfortunately, now you're the second most capped. Elise Perry is now the most capped. I think she's at 253 before the Women's Ashes test, maybe 254 when this is released. How proud are you of, you know, representing Australia 250 plus times? And then, you know, what was it like to see someone you played so many games with eclipse you?
Oh, look, to play one game for Australia is a great achievement. I'm astonished I was able to squeeze enough out of my talent to play for that long. I was absolutely chuffed that Elise Perry surpassed me. Like, what a legend. Yeah, what, arguably our greatest ever player. Still going strong. I know, her omission from the T20 side was a bit of a shock to people, and that'll spur her on to continue to grow her game. But, I'm so thrilled that it was Elise that surpassed me in that record, because a lot of the 251 games I played was alongside her, and she's a very special athlete, one that we're very lucky to have playing cricket. And I'm looking forward to watching her in a couple of days' time, the Ashes test match. Can't wait.
Absolutely. She's a trailblazer, but so have you been, Alex. I can't thank you enough for coming on Cricket Unfiltered again and Mena's Masterclass. If you're listening, go and find A Fair Game by Alex Blackwell with Megan Morris. It's an important book. You know, there are some sports autobiographies that are good, but I think this is not just very good, but important. So go and find it. And we'll, you know, be listening to you on ABC Grandstand, watching you on Fox Cricket. And I'm sure you're going to take some maternity leave soon. So best of luck with a huge year ahead.
Yep, big year ahead. Andrew, thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed that Mena's Masterclass as much as I did. I really love diving into the difficult issues that face our sport. Thanks again to our Patreon subscribers for supporting the podcast, and I'll be back soon with another Mena's Masterclass.
Sports Social Podcast Network.